First of all, thank you, everyone, for coming to the panel. We really appreciate it. Also, as the chair and the moderator, I am supposed to do all the housekeeping up front, so if you could just check your cell phones, make sure that they are off. This is a 90-minute session, so I will be speaking for about 10 or so minutes, as will all of the members of the panel, which should leave a pretty substantial time open for questions and answers. So if you have questions, and I'm sure you're going to, kind of keep track of them, and we'll have plenty of time at the end to have question and answer period. Okay, so polygamy. Those of you that have heard me speak on polygamy before know that I like to start with a little bit of a joke. I kind of like to address the elephant in the room of what is the definition of a cult. This is the same definition that I use with my students in lecture, and I think it makes a really good point. The definition of a cult is this: the church down the street from yours. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, on one hand, it's obviously a humorous point. It by no means is meant to belie the reality that cult behavior does exist. There are cults everywhere, both religious and otherwise. But what that definition does is really hint at what seems like a natural tendency to other, to make things different from us, strange and unusual, when in reality, unless we understand them, they're really not that different. To mainstream America, polygamy is different. And it's the anthropologist in me now that needs to just make a quick little notation that when we talk about polygamy, technically that just means more than one spouse. Polygyny is more than one wife. Polyandry is more than one husband. But I'm not even going to open that can of worms. In terms of polygyny, the reason that I make this definition clear up front is that throughout my presentation, there are times when I refer to it as polygamy because most people do. There are times when I refer to it as polygyny because that's what a lot of the supporting anthropological material does. So all that means is more than one wife. And it is different to mainstream American society. But it hasn't always been that way. And it certainly hasn't been that different to Mormonism. Mormonism has always had an uneasy alliance with the practice of polygamy. From Joseph Smith's revelation in D&C 132 to the Manifesto of 1890 to LDS Church denial of early polygamy to the recent release of official LDS essays confirming Smith's many polygamous unions on LDS.org to the reality that faithful LDS men can still be sealed to more than one woman simultaneously, polygamy has never really left the landscape of Mormonism. Currently, the LDS Church excommunicates members who practice polygamy and paints them as dangerous fundamentalists. The prevailing belief is that those who practice polygamy have been brainwashed into doing so by insular communities. To be fair, this can sometimes be the case within certain communities. But what of those whose journeys involve an active, fair, and free choice? A choice that's made as an adult. A choice that's arrived at after a journey through mainstream Mormonism. For contemporary Latter-day Saints, living a polygamous lifestyle is unequivocally outside the ecclesiastical boundaries of mainstream Mormonism. But for scholars, individuals who practice plural marriage are simply doing their Mormonism differently. As such, they are committed to their faith and are squarely located on the historic map of Mormon belief. However, the negative perception of polygamy in dominant American society continues to monopolize. And I want to address that before we move on to different kinds of polygamy. On August 29, 2006, Warren Jeffs, head of the Fundamentalist Mormon Church and notorious polygamist leader, was arrested just outside of Las Vegas. A fugitive on the FBI's most wanted list, Jeffs' arrest set off a firestorm of negative publicity, and rightly so. However, Jeff's arrest also epitomized and reinforced prevailing opinions regarding the currently illegal practice of polygamy in the United States. Fueled by popular publications of the time, both before and shortly after his arrest, the widespread understanding of this cultural practice is one of abuse, underage child brides, neglected and abandoned young boys, hopelessly controlled women at the mercy of their authoritative, power-hungry husbands, and this isn't always the case. This is not to suggest that these personal and painful accounts are fabrications. They are, in nearly every instance, the true and accurate lived experience of the storyteller. What becomes problematic, however, is that one person's story, even a collected group of stories taken from predominantly one community, cannot represent the larger cultural practice of polygamy, particularly when such a community is so diverse and particularly when the majority of those practicing polygamy reject the authority of Warren Jeffs. They are actively choosing to live their belief in plural marriage differently, to live their Mormonism differently. While sensational, salacious, and guaranteed to grab headlines across the nation, the story of Warren Jeffs and his community is not the whole story. It's not even the largest part. According to Ann Wild, who we're going to hear from in just a moment, polygamous families live by a variety of values and standards. Members of organized fundamentalist groups are often influenced by the traditions or expectations of the larger religious body with whom they identify. There are a number of different fundamentalist Mormon communities centered in and around Utah, including two larger groups, several smaller groups, and the independent fundamentalists who are not members of any organized group. And these polygamists make up the largest group of practicing polygamists in the United States. These groups are all united in their belief in celestial marriage and the practice of a plural lifestyle, but they are not united in presenting a cohesive picture of what this belief or practice looks like. However, many families practicing plural marriage illustrate a direct contradiction to media reports of American polygamy. Further, polygamy has historically provided benefits to women unacknowledged by mainstream society and continues to do so. Centennial Park, Arizona is one of these communities. Centennial Park, Arizona is where I have been conducting fieldwork for the last 5 years. It is a fundamentalist Mormon community challenging popular media images and perceptions of what it means to be a polygamist. Some members have been born into this community. Some members have actively chosen it as adults. Rejecting labels that have been imposed upon them by others, members of this community simply say they are engaged in the work. At other times, they may also call themselves Joseph Smith Mormons. Driving through this community is like driving through any other. Attire, while modest, is modern and does not serve as a telltale marker of plural living as it does with the pioneer dress found in Colorado City. However, the differences are more than skin deep for Centennial Park. First and foremost, marriage before the age of 18 is not permitted within this community, and it is women who typically choose spouse, not the men. In the event that a woman has not been moved by the Spirit through thoughtful prayer to identify her future spouse, she may consult the Council of Brethren for guidance. Yet even in the case, she ultimately makes the decision to marry. She is never assigned or forced to participate in plural marriage. Secondly, women, as well as men, are encouraged to further their education beyond high school. Many members of Centennial Park enroll in classes at Mojave Community College, located just minutes from the community. Mary Timpson, a formidable matriarch within the community, states in referencing Brigham Young, "Education is the power to think clearly. This is what we want for our children." In many plural families, women work outside of the home in professional jobs and are not diminished or chastised for doing so. In short, Centennial Park is a community just like any other found in America, with one glaring exception. Members of this community are committed to living a plural lifestyle and wish to do so out in the open. What becomes revolutionary about these families is their commitment to outwardly challenging popular representations of polygamy within the United States. As I noted earlier, polygamy is regularly equated with abuse and the subjugation of women in both media reports and popular opinion. However, these beliefs are squarely rooted in ontological privilege that upholds a dominant cultural pattern. However, and according to polygamy across cultural analysis, to many researchers, the question of a woman's subjugation to polygyny cannot be examined without focusing on the women themselves and their internal relationships. To a woman in a polygamous marriage, the bond to other females, including other co-wives, may constitute a more critical relationship than that with her husband for productive, reproductive, and personal achievements. It is therefore not possible to generalize as to whether polygyny is by nature competitive or cooperative. It depends on the particular polygynous context. A strong case can easily be made for polygamy as collaboration, wherein women do not shoulder the burden of a household alone. They rely on a close-knit group of women who share the same familial goals to find both joy and fulfillment from both within and without their family structures. It is time for interdisciplinary research and critical ethnography to bring much-needed opposition to the cacophony of prejudice currently commanding the loudest voice on the polygamous stage. It is my belief that as more people truly understand the workings of plural marriage, and this is important, as practiced by consenting adults, American culture in general will become more accepting of multiple familial structures. Indeed, all marginalized groups benefit from the power of self-determinations. Don't Mormons themselves want the right to define? When scholars remain open to the critical way that persons choose to present themselves, how they construct their identity, and ultimately how they embody, reflect, and construct their culture, they uncover contextual truths often hidden by the privilege embedded in a dominant narrative. Disrupting one's own privilege can be uncomfortable, but continuing to treat polygamy as taboo contributes to misunderstandings that, according to David Malow in Our Kind of Polygamy, create many social problems that could otherwise be minimized by giving the phenomenon the study and attention that it requires. So please, listen to these stories today. Respect the choices that are made by consenting adults, and realize that polygamy is never just one thing. Thank you.
When Jennifer asked me to be on this panel, I thought, oh, I can handle that, a story from mainstream to fundamentalist. I'll probably just take a few notes and read from that. And then as I got to thinking about what I'd like to say, I wanted to include a few scriptures that really influenced me in my decisions. So I decided I'd just write it out, so you'll forgive me. Ordinarily, I like to speak without notes. I do a lot of presentations to try and help people understand the lifestyle, talk to university classes and service providers and so forth, because I think one of the biggest problems in polygamy today is a misunderstanding of those who live it. Really, by definition, a fundamentalist Mormon is one who believes in the early doctrines of the church, as taught by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and so forth. And through the years, I'm sure you've all noticed, whether you're Mormon or not, really, that there have been a lot of changes, not only in the Mormon church, but in the Catholic church and others. They seem to evolve for good or bad, depending on your perspective. But I want people to understand that, really, out of a fundamentalist Mormon population, which are about 38,000, probably only half of those actually live in a plural family. But they do still believe in those early doctrines. And that's the distinction I would like to make, so that you understand when you hear the term fundamentalist Mormon, it's those who believe but not necessarily live. Some of them would like to, but they haven't had the opportunity. So I've titled my remarks, From Mainstream to My Dream, and as I go along with my talk here, you'll understand why I titled it that. Similar to Nephi, I was born and raised of goodly parents. I was born in 1936 when Heber J. Grant was president of the LDS Church, and at age 8, I was baptized in the Wilshire Ward in Los Angeles. I believed in the contemporary teachings of the church all through primary and high school and 4 wonderful years of BYU. During my young years, I remember bearing my testimony. It was a thing for young people to do then. They'd get up and say, I know the church is true, and Joseph Smith the prophet, and sit down. But I was kind of like that. My mother taught me I should get up and bear my testimony, so I did that. And I graduated then with honors from an institution, BYU, that I thought was the Lord's University at that time. A year later, I was married in the Los Angeles Temple in a ceremony that I felt would seal my husband and me together for eternity. In short, my beliefs and actions up to this point were those that brought happiness to my devout Mormon parents, which was especially important to me since at that time I was their only child. And we're related to Ezra Taft Benson and Parkinson's, and my mother was Stake Relief Society president. It was very important for them to know that I was a good little Mormon girl. Up to that point, I succeeded in accomplishing that wish. However, during my 9-year monogamous marriage, my life began to gradually take a different direction. Both my husband and I spent a great deal of time studying LDS church history and noticed discrepancies between early and current teachings. We also met several well-respected church members who pointed out to us doctrinal changes that had been made by LDS leaders since 1890. I began to question the accuracy of the stories I had learned growing up in the mainstream church. I think I understood how Brigham Young must have felt when he said, quote, "I have banished from my mind all the baby stories my mother taught me when I was a child." Of course, he was not a member of the church when he was a child, but there were biblical stories that apparently he felt were not the whole truth. Since my faith in contemporary church teachings was being shaken, I followed the admonition of the scriptures that said, quote, "And as all have not faith, seek ye diligently and teach one another words of wisdom. Yea, seek ye out of the best books words of wisdom." So I thought, well, that's a good key for me to follow. So I began studying out of books and to try and get a firm foundation upon which to build my testimony. I read, studied, prayed, fasted, investigated, and listened to others' testimonies. I wanted to find out for myself answers to the many questions that I had, such as, if God's eternal principles were true in the 1800s, then why shouldn't they still be true in the 1900s? Is there a difference between the church and the gospel? If so, can one be true and not the other? Can man change the eternal, unchangeable laws and doctrines of God? If so, how can they still be eternal and unchangeable if they can change them? Can priesthood of God exist separate from the LDS Church? And can these eternal laws be lived outside the mainstream church? So these are the questions that were developing in my mind, and my first husband and I began to do a lot of studying to see if we could find answers to them. So, let's see, the results of our study reinforced my doubts about the infallibility of current church leaders and their teachings. Nevertheless, my husband and I continued to attend meetings because we wanted to raise our three children in the church that we had loved all of our lives. It became more and more difficult, however, because we could not support the unconditional follow the brethren mandate so often repeated in church meetings. One of the LDS manuals about that time was even entitled Follow the Brethren. Maybe you'll remember that. I find nothing wrong with the statement, so long as the brethren follow their brethren earlier and the Lord. As our testimonies became stronger in the original and eternal laws of the gospel restored in this dispensation, we took comfort in the knowledge that the priesthood of God can and does exist separate from the LDS Church, thus providing the necessary authority for ordinances to be performed that the church had changed or rejected. After all, wasn't the priesthood restored to Joseph Smith before the church was organized in April 1830? So it must have existed separate from the church at that time, and that's just one of the examples. According to J. Reuben Clark, quote, "The priesthood can exist without the church, but the church cannot exist without the priesthood." Also, like Nephi, we knew, quote, "that the Lord giveth no commandments unto the children of men, save he shall prepare a way for them, that they may accomplish the thing which he commandeth them." So we felt that God had provided a way for these laws and ordinances to be continued as originally revealed. In October 1968, 9 years after an often troublesome marriage, my first husband and I divorced, not over religious differences, but over personality conflicts. To this day, however, I'm grateful for that marriage, as in addition to my three wonderful children, I gained from him a deeper understanding of the gospel, learned patience and tolerance, and met many wonderful, like-minded people, one of whom was Ogden Kraut. Ogden was a gospel doctrine teacher, and to supplement the milquetoast information in the lesson manuals, he researched and wrote several articles on various gospel subjects. He needed a typist. I volunteered. I majored in business education, and I loved typing, and I helped supplement our income by typing theses and things. So it became a very good partnership, and this was the day before computers, and I'll never forget how excited I was when Ogden, I lived in Logan, he lived down in another part of the state. He brought an IBM Correcting Selectric, and I thought it was magic. The subjects of some of these articles eventually became books, the first one being Jesus Was Married, which was published in February of 1969. We were so excited when we picked up the first 500 hardback copies from the binders. We got some chicken dinners and rushed over to N.B. Lundwall's home to celebrate. Ogden and I had become good friends with Nels Lundwall and had been attending some of the study groups he held in his home. I don't know if all of you are familiar with that name, but he was in secretary to the Quorum of 70 and compiled a lot of books. He made several trips down to southern Utah, and on the last trip he made down there, he took several of our Jesus Was Married books and sold quite a few. However, unfortunately, Nels Lundwall died the month after our book came out in March of 1969. Ogden was even one of the speakers at his funeral. After the divorce, I had custody of four children, ages 2 to 8. In addition to my three, a wonderful Navajo girl had been living with us on the LDS Indian Education Program. Naturally, I was very concerned about my future. How was I going to support these children? Should I sell my home in Logan and move to Salt Lake City? What about remarriage? Ogden and I both believed in plural marriage, and we had recently discussed the possibility of my becoming part of his family. I desperately needed comfort and direction from the Lord. Without going into detail, and after much fasting and prayer, I was literally led to the scripture in D&C 78, quote, "And ye cannot bear all things now, nevertheless be of good cheer, for I will lead you along." As I read this passage, it was as though an audible voice was speaking just to me. I immediately felt peace and knew that the Lord would give me the direction that I needed. But for the present, I was to live by faith and not make any long-term decisions in my life. And this later proved to be a very correct course to take. In time, I became Ogden's second wife, but only after I received divine guidance and undeniable answers to my prayers. I had an experience, and a lot of the answers to prayers are a little bit too personal to share, but I would like to share one experience that I had after we were sealed. It reassured me that I had made the right decision. One beautiful spring day, I was sitting by a stream in Manti where Ogden had purchased an old home that we were fixing up. I was meditating and thanking the Lord for the blessing of living plural marriage and how grateful I was for being sealed to such a wonderful man. I found myself singing softly the words to a song that I had not thought about since I was a teenager. It was the third verse to the song, "Tell Me Why." I really think that God above created you for me to love. He picked you out from all the rest because he knew I loved you best. Now, these are just words to a song, and I know a lot of people say, well, you're reading more into it than you really had. But when you have a feeling that you can't express, that's what I experienced, and that's what reassured me that I really had made the correct decision, because I felt like in the pre-existence we made a covenant to be sealed in marriage, and that we made that covenant there to be sealed in marriage here. During our 33 years of marriage, I helped Ogden write, edit, and print 65 books on church history and doctrine, as well as type and publish countless publications for other people. We shared numerous spiritual experiences, met literally thousands of people who wanted to discuss his writings, enjoyed several amazing trips and adventures, and together defended the fullness of the gospel at every opportunity. Ogden and I felt we had a mission together. We shared the same religious beliefs and enjoyed working side by side, writing, printing, and discussing those beliefs. As his plural wife, I felt needed, important, appreciated, loved. And isn't that what most women want in a marriage? From my youth, it was my dream to find a companion like that, and I was fortunate enough to have that dream come true. That's why I entitled these Sunstone remarks, "From Mainstream to My Dream," because I don't see how this dream could have possibly been fulfilled in such a marvelous way had I remained in the mainstream LDS church. As you can imagine, it was a very sad day for me and for his family when he passed away July 17, 2002, at age 75. As an independent fundamentalist Mormon, I have never joined an organized group, but am fortunate to have many wonderful friends in nearly all of them, as well as among the independents. I have maintained my love for the mainstream LDS church and occasionally even attend some of the meetings and events. I have never for one minute regretted the path I felt inspired to take. Rather, I have considered it a privilege and a blessing to be able to defend and try to live the fullness of the gospel. Through it all, I still consider myself to be a Mormon, in spite of opinions to the contrary, and would like to close my remarks with a short poem I wrote for this occasion. This is my conclusion. A Mormon is what I will always be, willing to shout it from the highest tree. Gospel teachings of service, love and salvation guide and direct me toward exaltation. Though others may judge from their point of view and say that this statement is certainly not true, in my heart and soul, with no remorse or shame, I want to be known by the Mormon name. Feminist, liberal, conservative and gay, orthodox, black, even inactive are okay. Since Mormons vary widely under the sun, why can't I be a fundamentalist one? I believe Joseph's a prophet and always will be. He restored the true gospel I will love eternally. His teachings are a guide in all that I do, his example a light that brightly shines through. I'm a descendant of polygamous Mormons of old. An eternal law they obeyed, I have often been told. So please don't wrongly identify me, for a Mormon is what I will always be. Thank you.
My name is Kevin Kraut. I'm the son of Ogden Kraut. I'm the fifth child out of my mother, the first wife, Louise McBride Kraut. I was born at Dugway Proving Grounds, which is already weird, if anybody knows about Dugway. And my life has been weird. My life has been strange. Today, even a gentleman said, "You're weird." And it is. It is a weird life. So I'm going to try and explain some of the weirdness that happened in my family and tell some spiritual stories at the same time. When I was born, even before I was born, I actually had some recollection of my pre-earth life. And I told my sister this, and she recorded this, and she said, and in that experience, I came to a point, and there was an angel. And the angel said, "Oh, I want to show you what your life will be like." And so I saw this life, and it was a gentleman that lived in Provo, and there was a nice family, and I went to BYU, and there was a nice car and a nice girl and lots of money, and it was kind of peachy. And I said, "Yeah, that's a good one. I like that life." And then he said, "Okay, there's another one here." And then he showed me this one over here with the Kraut family. And this family, they were poor, and everybody didn't like them, and they didn't have nice sports cars, and there was lots of problems. And I said, "Heck, I don't want that one. No way. I don't want anything to do with that." And he said, "No, stop and think about it." He said, "This one, this last one, will prepare you better for your mission." And I said, "Okay, I'll go." And so I remember the angel actually bringing me and pointing to my mother. And then I remember going down. And several months later, after I was born in this particular house, our family moved. And so when I was about 4 or 5 years old, I walked up to my mom and I said, "Hey, when we were at this other house, there was this... this piece of furniture, and it was in the foot of the bed. Do you remember that?" And she says, "Yeah." And she says, "What else do you remember?" And, "Well, there's no way I would have known that, but see, I'd seen it in vision." And so she brought my dad in and said, "Okay, tell this to your dad." And so I told him all about what was the furniture and where it was. And he said, "Okay, so how did you know that?" And I said, "Well, the angel that brought me to Mom, I could see everything in the room. I could see everything in the house." And he goes, "Okay, so did you see this? And did you see this?" And I said, "Yes, I did. I did see those things." And so from that moment on, I was a weird kid. And my family saw some strange things with me. In fact, my father had a seer stone that actually belonged to Joseph Smith. It was called the Belcher Stone. Has anybody seen that or heard of the Belcher Stone? So that was in our home, and so Dad used to say, well, you know, you can look in here and see things. And so one day, my friend stole my toy, and so I went in and I grabbed the stone and looked in the stone, and I saw that it was in his desk on the right-hand corner. So I went and told the teacher, my toy is right there in his desk in this thing. And so she went over and unlocked it and opened it up, and there it was. And she said, so how did you know that? I better not tell her the real reason, so I didn't. And so from that moment, I learned, okay, I have this gift, I can see certain things, but I never told too many people about it. And so I kept pretty quiet about that. In fact, one strange event was with N.B. Lundwall, and I was in his house. It was late, and I was a little guy, and I went walking into the kitchen, and as I walked into the kitchen, there was this bright, bright being there, an angel. And I looked up, and I saw this angel, and I was like, wow. And he just smiled at me, that's all. Just smiled and then disappeared. Out he went. And so at that point, I went and asked my dad. I said, well, who is this man, N.B. Lundwall? And he says, well, he's a very spiritual man. He wrote these books. He did these things. And I asked him, was he an apostle? Is he an apostle? And he says, well, maybe not in the way that the church sees it, that he's, you know, part of the brethren or part of that, but he may have seen Christ and he may be an apostle. So I started having these experiences at a very young age. And at 14, my mom and dad separated and I moved down to Arizona. And my dad stayed up here. And we started, I was very much LDS. I was an Eagle Scout. I got four palms. And I served an LDS mission. And it was an interesting thing when I, because I got a lot of answers to prayers. I truly did. And so one night I was listening to a talk tape, and it was by Matthew Calley. And it was a talk tape called Miracles. And it was so impressive on my mind, the beautiful miracles, because I'd seen those kind of miracles, that I knelt down right there after the tape and I said, Heavenly Father, I want to go to a place just like this. And so, and experience what Matthew Calley did, that same type of experience. So I got my mission call to New Zealand, exactly where Matthew Calley was. The three people that he had experiences with, I won't go into detail for time. I had all three of those experiences. I met the lady's son. I met the one man who got his sight back. I had all the same experiences that he had in that particular New Zealand area. So then, after my mission, I went to school, I finished up, and I felt impressed to come to BYU. And so when I came to BYU, at that time, I really wanted to talk to my dad more about his religion. Why did he believe this? Why did he go into, you know, polygamy of all things? I just wanted to know. Well, my dad had a heart attack, and I had been a paramedic down in Tucson area, and the University of Utah said there's a new thing called a stent that they would put in a heart down in Arizona. If I took him down, we could go down and get that fixed. So we did. And on the way down, I thought, this might be my last chance. I'm going to ask my dad all the questions. And so on the way down, I asked all these questions about polygamy, about this. That was the first time in my life I ever read 132 and found out that that was the question that Joseph was asking. Why did these men live plural marriage? Why did they do this? Because in the LDS church, you're not taught that. You're just, for some reason, you're kind of blank to the whole 132 thing. So that changed my life. And then I asked him all these other questions. It was the first time that I learned my dad had a third wife with three other children. And one of those children was a girl And since I've been 8 years old, I kept saying, I have a sister, and she loves animals. And everybody looked at me with a blank look, and then I found out when I was 25, because they had to keep all this very quiet, that I had a sister who loved animals. And I finally got to meet her. And so so there was a lot of interesting experiences that happened between that time, but in that one trip, I was totally converted to fundamentalism. My dad said, I ask every question. I never stopped. Okay, well, if that's this, then this is this. And if that's that, I want to know this. And I want to understand this. Well, I got down to Arizona. My dad got his heart fixed and came in. And my mother was really upset because she could tell I was converted in one day. Because all the answers were there. For so long in the church, I'd asked so many questions that nobody answered. And so what about the Adam God doctrine? What about some of these other doctrines? What about rebaptism? Why don't they rebaptize people anymore? And they used to do it every, you know, before they went on a mission, before they got the priesthood. Some women were rebaptized before they had a baby. What a beautiful concept. And so those made huge impressions on me. And so at that time, I was pretty much converted to the church, and now I'm converted to fundamentalism. And that's what happens with a lot of people, because they start getting the answers and they start understanding it. Which way the Lord takes them is entirely up to them and how the Lord will make them go. And in my life, eventually, I was excommunicated for doctrine. I mean, no sin, no anything. I got in, and the state president, you know, there's lots of questions, and I was answering those questions, and the state president said, Kevin, you're converting my high council. And I was, because I was answering those questions. One gentleman stood up and he says, I've asked these questions for 25 years, and in 2 minutes you've answered those questions. And so my answer to most of this is that the fundamentalist people, as it was foretold, there was a group that would come out of the church that would push spiritual things to the forefront. And I think that's what the fundamentalist people have done. They've tried to push these old religious principles back up so people can understand them and understand what they were for. And having known that my dad wrote 60 books or so on it, it was an amazing thing to me, because he could always hand me a book. Here, this is the answers in here. Read this book. By the way, our website, ogdenkraut.com, has all those books online for free. So you can go read about rebaptism. You can read about spiritual experiences. We actually have a picture. We don't have it online, but we have a picture of the old Belcher stone. And I also have YouTubes that I tell all my stories, because I like to tell stories. It's under Kevin Kraut, so you can go see those. So after all of these times and after all these experiences, I also had one other experience that was quite unique. I'd grown up with a gentleman named Pat Smart from little kids. And I met him at BYU, and we were kind of going to school, and then later he left and went to Hollywood. And he came back, and he found out my beliefs. And Pat was the only person that I know who ever, wherever he went, all the girls would look at him. Didn't matter whether they're old, young, he was just one of those impeccable, perfect male figures. And I kept saying, look, there's a girl, why aren't you dating her? Why aren't you going out with him? Finally, one day he stopped and he said, Kevin, he says, you don't understand. I'm gay. And I was like, wow, really? I just didn't catch that one. And he sat me down and explained how everything happened and where he went with his life. And he said, you know, I know there's a girl out there. I know I was supposed to marry her. I know I was supposed to do this stuff. I took this other path. And he said, I want you to go find that girl and marry her. And I went, okay, well, so that's how I got into fundamentalism. And that's how some of the events happened in my life. And knowing right now the deeper doctrines that were part of the old religion, has been very, very satisfying to me. It's been a very important thing for me to have the knowledge and to be able to sit there and understand why they did things. Why did Joseph Smith live plural marriage? Why did these other people live plural marriage? Those are answers that all of us deserve to know. So, anyway, time's up. Thanks.
My name is Christine Mackley-Dye, and I was born into the best family in the whole world. I was born in an active LDS family. I had seven other siblings, some respected in our little Idaho community. My parents, they didn't just live the gospel, they loved the gospel, and they taught their children to live and love the gospel too. And for me, the gospel was a good fit. I loved it. As a teenager, I came to the conclusion that there wasn't anything more important in the world than the gospel. And particularly, I loved the concept of personal revelation. It was, and still is, fascinating to me to think that we can commune with a God who knows the end from the beginning and what's best for us, and that's available to us. And even when I was very young, I couldn't imagine why we wouldn't spend our entire lifetime and all of our time trying to access that rather than all of the other things that people spend our entire lives time doing. And so the gospel was my life. And eventually I went to Ricks College, which, as you know, is now BYU-Idaho, and I met a really neat gal named Lisa Dye, and she kept saying, "You just really need to meet my brother who was going to BYU." And so we did meet each other, and a few short days later we were engaged. We just felt like we had known each other forever, and I believe we had. We were married in the Idaho Falls Temple, and we spent the first 13 years of our lives living and loving the gospel and being active and furiously active in the LDS church. And then one day we found out that some of our good friends had left the church to join an apostate polygamous group. And we loved them so much that we called them and said, "Can we take you out to dinner?" And we were going to save them. And we took them out to dinner. And while they were talking with us, my good friend Carol said something, and the Spirit burned in my heart. You know, I felt like my bosom was on fire. And I thought, no wonder poor Carol is deceived, because this feels just like the Holy Ghost. But it never did not occur to me the possibility that it was the Holy Ghost. And as we were driving home from taking them out to dinner, we drove past the Rocky Ridge community, and they pointed at it and said, "Yeah, this is where we work at this cabinet shop." And it brought back another memory that I had that was almost as unfathomable, of when we had built our home, I went to go get a bid at that cabinet shop. I had been told that even though they were polygamous, they do really good cabinets. And as I was I thought, well, good, even if. But as I was driving out of that community, my heart started burning. I felt like my heart was on fire. And I came home, you know, from the bid cabinet shop experience and said, "David, I do not get this, but those apostates over there, they have a pretty good spirit." And he said, "Now, don't go weird on me or anything, will you?" And I didn't. I totally forgot about it for a long, long time. However, it came back to my mind when they pointed it out. Still, I thought, that just goes to show you they have something that feels just like the Spirit. So we prayed and prayed and prayed for Carol and Scott, but you know the men, they deserve what they get, right? But but we prayed and prayed, and the Spirit said to me, "If you want to save Carol, learn what she learned." And so we together embarked on a study, and I was not really very concerned, or I expected that I would find questions that I would have to put on the shelf. I expected to not find all the answers. What I didn't expect was for the Spirit to get so involved. And as I started to learn, and Anne did a really good job talking about some of the things that I started to learn about the differences between the doctrines that were taught by Joseph Smith and the changes, the doctrines that have been abandoned by the church. What I didn't expect was to continually feel the Spirit. And I didn't expect to feel not only, to read not only to the intellectual that just rang true, like it was as familiar as all the parts of the gospel that I already loved, but to feel those spiritual witnesses at the same time, particularly when I read an account of the 1886 revelation, which, if you aren't familiar with that, it's when John Taylor in 1886 was counseling with his counselors about maybe they better issue some kind of a statement about to stop plural marriage, and he said, well, I'll take it to the Lord. And that night he was visited by Christ and by Joseph Smith, and the next morning he called five men together, and they were given the authority, he was given a revelation that the Lord would never abrogate plural marriage because it was a divine concept. I just distinctly remember thinking, this feels just like the first vision to me. And so that launched me into an internal battle. And one internal battle, there were kind of two sides to this internal battle. One was, could the church possibly be wrong? I was holding and had a strong conviction that the Lord would never allow the mainstream LDS church, the policies, to be led astray. That, and I couldn't put that together with these collection of the Spirit telling me something different. And the Spirit had been such a companion to me in my life. I didn't feel like I could abandon my companion. I didn't feel like I could abandon my, but the church. But probably the more deeper, heart-wrenching battle was the thought, the possibility that the Lord really does sustain plural marriage. To me, it made my blood curdle to think about it. It was demeaning. It was demoralizing. It was not fair. I wanted to be the one and only of my one and only. It seemed fair to me, and I wanted that exclusive relationship. And I didn't. It wasn't just the exclusive physical relationship. It was the emotional relationship. It was the best friend relationship. I could not fathom how that wasn't what the Lord wanted for every woman. And I battled that for a long time. And at some point in time, I actually got kind of mad at everything and even God for kind of giving me two stories and everything. And I finally got to the point where I just was able to get on my knees and say, Heavenly Father, I choose you. I love the Spirit in my life. I can't live without it. Whatever you say, if you say it's the best thing for me, I believe you. I trust you. I will do whatever. I put my steering wheel on the altar. And from then on, the peace came. And from then on, it wasn't me fighting to say, will I do this? It was then trying to determine, should I do this? Is it true? And we kept learning and studying and processing that for another 3 years. And it's a long story to how we got there. But eventually we started associating with the AUB. And in time, I got a sister wife, and in time, I got another sister wife. And I have had the privilege and the opportunity to live in a plural situation for 12 years. And I have come to the conviction that I prefer it, that is the marriage pattern of the gods, that we were, as sisters, we were born to be sister wives. And if we can, and it takes a little bit of work, but it's possible to put aside the things that make it miserable. They're natural, but they are not necessary. And to love it. And what the men that it creates, and the women and the children who have multiple love languages, multiple teaching styles, plural families are bigger, richer, fuller, crazier, bigger. But we have a whole big piece of the pie. Gospel living is blessed life, but monogamous gospel living is just missing a piece of the gospel pie that is delicious. Anyway, so that's my story.
Big step on the end of the stage over there. My name's Stan Shepp. I'm a fundamentalist. I'm Mormon through and through. I believe in Joseph Smith. The basis of my faith came from Catholicism. I'm devoutly Christian. Jesus Christ is a very important part of my life. The atonement is very valuable to me. I have two wives. I live in Centennial Park, Arizona. I have five children. Right now they are aged 6, 3, 2, 7 months, and 7 weeks. Three of them are in diapers. If you think this is all about the sex, you should come down to my house because it's all about changing diapers. I'm a little concerned about a confirmation bias. A lot of you have come here, you saw the polygamy, and you have your beliefs and your feelings on polygamy, and whatever I have to say is not likely to change those thoughts or beliefs, but I'm going to say it anyway. And I'm not going to use my own words, at least for most of it. I'm going to use the words of the prophets of the LDS Church. I'd like to address a few things first, before I get into any of the quotes that I share. The greatest fundamentalist belief, the foundation of fundamentalism, the foundation of Mormonism, the battle in heaven, the battle that we wage on earth, is about agency. Now, a lot of Mormon fundamentalists are accused of not believing in agency. And I want to tell you that in Centennial Park, Arizona, we believe in agency. It is a top priority. You get to choose what you do. Nobody tells you what to do. Nobody comes into my home and tells me what to do. Nobody tells me what to teach my family. I'm encouraged to teach my family. I'm encouraged to have Sunday school, but nobody tells me what to teach. Nobody calls me up and checks to see if I did teach. Agency. And now, bring in agency, into plural marriage, I believe that it is a woman's right to choose who she mates with and who helps her to raise her children. And I don't believe that that right can be taken away from her in any sense. So, it's the year of the women. The future is the women. This is a woman's law. There's a lot of single women in the church. Somebody earlier in a different session said the math doesn't work out. And I could sit here and try to explain to you that even in our isolated community, as long as our community is growing, if the boys get married when they're 20 and the girls get married when they're 18, and there's an equal number of each year, but an increasing amount each year, then there's 18 20-year-olds and 20 18-year-olds. So there's two extra women every year, and it does work out. I could get into all that. But I'd like to share this statistic with you that is about 10 years old. The number of single LDS women in the greater Las Vegas area, which includes up to St. George and Cedar City, 22,000 single LDS women that are looking for a good, spiritual, righteous husband. Centennial Park, we could probably come up with about 300. And if you divide that 22,000 into our community of 300, I can't handle my share. It's a problem that we have an answer to, but we don't have the means to institute that solution. And so this is a solution to the problem that the church has with single women who are looking for husbands, but we're certainly going to need some help. On with the quotes. So I'm going to share some quotes with you from the church. I was raised Catholic, converted to Mormonism. I studied Mormonism, and through the study of Mormonism, I discovered fundamentalism before I ever knew what a fundamentalist was, ever knew that a fundamentalist existed. I knew nothing about the groups. I lived in Pennsylvania. And so these were some of the things that I studied that made me question what happened. This is from the Journal of Discourses, Heber C. Kimball, Volume 5, page 204 and 205, October 12th. 1856. He said, "Some quietly listen to those who speak against the Lord's servants, against his anointed, against the plurality of wives, and against almost every principle that God has revealed. Such people have half a dozen devils with them all the time. You might as well deny Mormonism and turn away from it as to oppose the plurality of wives. Let the presidency of this church and the 12 apostles and the authorities unite and say with one voice that they will oppose that doctrine, and the whole of them would be damned. What are you opposing it for? It is a principle that God has revealed for the salvation of the human family. He revealed it to the prophet Joseph Smith in this our dispensation, and that which he revealed, he designs to have carried out by his people." Well, I believe that the presidency of the church, the quorum of the 12, and the leaders of the church have denounced plural marriage and abandoned it. "Many of these people have broken their covenants by finding fault with the plurality of wives and trying to sink it out of existence, but you cannot do that. God will cut you off and raise up another people. Another people that will carry out his purposes in righteousness unless you walk up to the line in your duty." It was Heber C. Kimball. Journal Discourses, Volume 4, page 108. "What would be necessary to bring about the result nearest to the hearts of the opponents of Mormonism, more properly termed the gospel of the Son of God? Simply to renounce, abrogate, or apostatize from the new and everlasting covenant of marriage in its fullness. Were the church to do that as an entity, God would reject the saints as a body. The authority would be withdrawn." I'll repeat that. "The authority would be withdrawn with its gifts and its powers, and there would be no more heavenly recognition of the administrations among the people. The heavens would permanently withdraw themselves, and the Lord would raise up another people, of greater valor and stability. For his work must, according to his unalterable decrees, go forward. For the time of the second coming is near, even at the doors. Therefore, the saints have no alternative but to stand by the truth and sustain that what the heavens have established and proposed to perpetuate. This they will do, come life or death, freedom or imprisonment, or there is, so far as we can observe, no use to attempt to disguise this fact. Charles Penrose, recorded in the Deseret Evening News, April 23rd, 1885. The entire church and all of its priesthood, with the presidency at the head of it, might motion and vote against this principle until doomsday with just one effect, namely, to vote themselves away from the fellowship of the Holy Ghost, from the possession of the priesthood, and to find themselves very speedily outside the church and the kingdom of God, while he would raise up others that would honor and observe this law. Deseret News Editorial, April 1st, 1885. These are prophets from the LDS Church saying, if you reject plural marriage, the keys of the priesthood will be withdrawn from you and given to another people. In my eyes, the church has given up the principle of plural marriage. And if these men are prophets, the church no longer has the keys. Those keys have been removed and given to another people. So my question, as a Mormon, where are those keys? Where are these people? Because that's important to me. Journal of Discourses, Volume 11, John Taylor, June 7th, 1866. When this commandment was given, it was so far religious and so far binding upon the elders of the church that it was told them, if they were not prepared to enter into it and stem the torrent of opposition that would come in consequence of it, the keys of the kingdom would be taken from them and given to others. John Taylor, October 10th, 1882, Life of Wilford Woodruff. If we do not embrace that principle soon, the keys will be turned against us. John Taylor, Deseret News Weekly, 1885, February 25th. Though they may imprison or kill most Mormons, there will always be someone left to carry on the work. George Q. Cannon, 1882, Journal Discourses, Volume 23, page 280. If God saves this people, as I firmly believe he will, it will be through those men and through those women whom men have placed under a ban, whom men have said shall have no power because of the laws that are enacted against them. I tell you, the salvation that will come to this people will be through the faithfulness of the men of God and the women of God who, in the face of an opposing world, contrary to their traditions, to their education, to their preconceived notions, and to the popular prejudices of the day, who have in the midst of all this, stepped forward in the vanguard and obeyed the command of God and have dared to endure all the consequences and have been willing to endure all the penalties. Try to wrap up soon.
You got about 3 minutes before I say.
All right. I could give you this for an hour. Plural marriage was restored. It was not restored to be mocked. It was not restored to be degraded. It was not restored to cause sadness. It was restored because it was part of the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The priesthood was given to the men in the church so that they could live this law. And when they rejected this law, it was taken from them. The priesthood was taken and it was given to another group. And so, what does the Lord say about, or what do these prophets say about this other group? Where would it come from? Would he just take it and give it to the Jews? Journal of Discourses, Volume 11, Heber C. Kimball, page 145, October 6, 1865. The majority of the members of this church are the very elect of God. There are some that are not so good, who care not for God, for his servant Brigham, for Heber, nor for the 12 apostles. But the day will come when the Lord will choose a people out of this people upon whom he will bestow his choicest blessings. Out of this people. Journal Discourses, Volume 18, page 96, Daniel Wells, October 7th, 1875. Many will doubtless make shipwreck of their faith and will be led away by the allurements of sin, by the forbidden paths. Yet the kingdom will not be taken from this people and given to another, but a people will come forth from among us who will be zealous of good works, willing to do the bidding of the Lord, who will be taught in his ways and will walk in his paths. We, if we are willing, may be humble instruments in the hands of God in bringing to pass his great and glorious kingdom. Orson F. Whitney, Deseret News, 1889. I know there's a people in the heart's core of this people that will rise in their majesty in a day that is near at hand and push spiritual things to the front. A people that will stand up for God. I could go on. There's prophecies that the priesthood would be taken from the people if they rejected plural marriage, and they did. If these men are prophets, if the church was true in that day, then the Lord took the priesthood from the church, and he took a people from the heart's core of the LDS church, and he gave them the priesthood. And he gave them the right to carry on plural marriage. And we've heard a little bit about the 1886 revelation. There was a manifesto that was presented to John Taylor, 1886. It had already been written. It wasn't a revelation to Wilford Woodruff. It had already been written. It had been presented to him to sign. Before he signed it, he took it to the Lord and said, "Can we give up plural marriage?" And the Lord gave him the 1886 revelation. And in that revelation, he said, "I have not given it up, and I cannot give it up. It's an everlasting covenant." So I'm here to tell you today that the priesthood does exist on the earth. All of the fundamentalist factions are descendants of the men that were set apart in 1886. We all have various claims to how we are the ones that have that priesthood. The Allreds claim that they have it. The Kingstons claim that they have it. Warren Jeffs, I think, claims that he has it. I don't know much about Warren Jeffs. My claim is that we have it, that it's in Centennial Park, Arizona. We live the doctrine of plural marriage, but that's not all we live. Fundamentalism is about priesthood. It's not about plural marriage. It's not about Adam God, but we believe in Adam God. It's not about gathering, but we believe in gathering. It's not about agency, but we believe in agency. We believe all of the fundamentalist principles, but fundamentalism to me is about priesthood. And that's why I'm in Centennial Park, is because I've followed that priesthood lineage down from the men that John Taylor set apart in 1886, preparatory to the priesthood being removed from the LDS church because they knew it was going to happen for 50 years. They tried to get the people to believe it. They knew it was going to happen. The scene was set. The people were there. It was prophesied. It was told. The people still rejected it. And that priesthood lineage is worth searching out. And I leave that with you. I'll say it. I leave in the name of Jesus Christ.
Again, thank you for coming to the panel. As you can tell just by the stories of the four people that are up here sharing their journey into plural marriage, every story is different. I am blessed today to have so many of my sisters here in the audience. And I don't mean sisters in metaphorical sisters, although they're all right there. I'm talking about my biological, wonderful sisters. They're all right there. Woo, woo. And even though some of my sisters and I grew up in the same household and some didn't, we're all bonded, but we all have tremendously different stories. And each of us has tremendously different stories. The reason that I wanted to put this panel together and why it was so important to me comes down to the fact that consenting adults should be able to structure their family to follow their faith in any way that they see fit. In this room right now, much like Anne was talking about in her poem, we have all kinds of Mormons, and we also have people who don't identify as Mormon. We have people who identify as fundamentalists, people who identify as faithful members of the LDS church, members who have left the church. We even have people in here who don't believe in God. And all of us are seeking out our truth. And respecting that truth is what's the most important. And so I'd like to open the last time that we have before the panel's over for any questions and answers. We're going to turn the mics on at the table here. So if you have a question for anyone on the panel, go ahead. You guys want to flip on the mics?
I think most all of you made it clear that you're not just talking about plural marriage, but you're talking about other fundamentalist original doctrines. I guess I have a question to you or any of you. If African-American member of LDS Church decide they want to come into your group, can they hold this priesthood, or is that part of the fundamentalist doctrine that blacks can't hold the priesthood?
We have had blacks in our community, and we have baptized them and encouraged them and loved them in our community. We have not given them the priesthood.
Just to add to that, that's always been a question that when I give presentations, it's asked, and what do we think about the blacks? The way I answer that is we feel like they are entitled to their equal civil rights just the same way as we are. Religious rights are a little bit different, and like Stan suggested, most of the fundamentalist Mormons do not advocate or encourage black male members to hold the priesthood.
Two quick questions. One is, there's been a lot of research about the detriment in broader society of families where the father is absent with single mothers. And I wonder whether there are any similar concerns in a plural family where the father's time is so divided among his family that he doesn't have the ability to spend time with his children. And then my second question would be about the position of many of these groups on polyandry.
Well, I can answer the first part of that question. Somebody else can answer the second. In any large family, like a family, monogamous family with 10 children, you're going to have trouble giving one-on-one time from the parents to the children. One thing that I appreciated is one of the plural wife friends that I have, her father had several wives. They lived in kind of a cul-de-sac area. And so she always knew where her father was, and if she ever needed him, she was welcome in any of the other mothers' homes. And her comment was, I love plural marriage. I want to raise my children the same way because there are more people to love me and more people for me to love. It's really all about families. Naturally, the logistics would be a challenge, but the quality time, I think, enters in, and you just do the best you can. Now, what was the second
polyandry? Personally, I make a concerted effort to be in my home. Both my wives and I live in the same home. Most of the families in our community live under one roof. I do the best I can to be there. I haven't been there in the last 2 days, and there's a feeling of my absence at home, I've been told. And so I get to drive 5 hours tonight so that I'm there in the morning when they wake up, while I would rather sleep here tonight and drive home tomorrow. As far as I'm assuming you're asking about women having more than one husband, and it makes no difference to me if a woman wants to have more than one husband. I have a woman friend who has two husbands. They're not in a religious organization at all. I don't see how it would fit into our community and our beliefs. It really doesn't fit into the Mormon theme, but I certainly wouldn't stop them from having their rights to do that. I mean, I don't want the government or my neighbors involved in my marriage, and so I return that favor, and don't want to be involved in theirs.
Next question.
Thank you all so much for sharing your story so eloquently and with such vulnerability and strength. I have a demographic question. Ann named the statistic, I think it was 38,000 fundamentalist Mormons in the U.S. and 50% are practicing plural marriage.
Probably fewer than 50%.
Okay, so it's a rough estimate. And my question is, I've read this and I've heard this before, but it's still somehow difficult for me to wrap my head around that. And I'm pretty sure it's because all the images from popular culture, convey that fundamentalist Mormonism and polygyny are interchangeable. So I guess what I'm interested in hearing from any of you are just, some brief stories or anecdotes of those people in your community who aren't practicing plural marriage. What are some of the reasons, behind that? And really, how do they feel about not practicing plural marriage?
I do just want to start real quick. Obviously, I don't know people who are in that category. I'm not living in that community. But just this is a question that comes up all the time in anthropology. And if you take a look at marriage patterns worldwide, the most preferred type of marriage is polygyny. The most common is monogamy. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. Most of them tend to be cultural and socioeconomic as well. That being the head of a polygamous family requires resources that a lot of times people don't have. So there's that aspect of it from the anthropological side. But as far as actual specific, I'll let you guys handle that aspect
of
the question.
Reasons why there's, and that's just a rough estimate about, there are younger people. That 38,000 includes children. Some are widows. I'm a widow, so I'm not actually living in a plural family right now, but I certainly definitely believe in it, and I consider myself a polygamist. There are teenagers or maybe young 20-year-olds that just haven't had the opportunity yet. There are monogamous couples that are looking for somebody, but, you just don't go out and say, oh, do you want to come into our family? This is a matter of prayer and selection and making sure it's a good fit. A lot of times it's important to consider, are the wives going to get along? Because the husband might be off at work, and he needs to make a decision where there needs to be harmony in the family, and so he wants to make sure those wives are going to get along, hopefully. So there's a lot of reasons why that number came up.
Thank you so much for coming. I really applaud your courage in coming and speaking in front of normal Mormons would be terrifying, but in front of like raving liberal Mormons like this group tends to be, it's got to be pretty scary. But my question is just the references that you gave from the Journal of Discourses, are those mostly found in the books that your father wrote as well? Yep. Like if I wanted to find those without actually having to read through the entire
book. Yeah, we just thought, okay, he's reading from our books.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I really enjoyed it. Kind of what I understand the goal of fundamentalism is to try and bring us back to the original doctrine as taught by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor. So something that you've mentioned is that there have been a lot of changes since 1890, but I'm wondering if maybe we can kind of take that back and say that there have been changes since 1830 as well. Kind of doctrinal developments in the life of Joseph Smith that we kind of see maybe in the Book of Mormon, it says that God has been God from eternity to eternity. And then we see in King Follett, he says God has not been God from eternity to eternity. So I want to know if you guys see sort of a stability in the doctrine from 1830 to 1890, or how you would deal with those sort of developments. Thank you.
Well, of course, Joseph Smith, when he's restoring a church or anything like that, you don't just know everything all at once. You go from grace to grace, from principle to principle. And so there are times when I'm sure things changed, even right from the beginning, like you mentioned. I think you have to credit that to the fact that he was still learning. He didn't know the whole thing at once, and so he added principle upon principle. Like his Kirtland doctrines are very different from the Nauvoo teachings that he had, because he had learned a lot since then.
The reason why most fundamentalists talk about 1890 is because at 1890, that's where major shifts happened. And so they kind of, that's a pivotal time for when things began to happen. And so, but yes, there were a lot of differences.
I have another short quote. It was in a letter to Lot Smith, who was a church leader in Arizona. This was written in 1887. Wilford Woodruff wrote to him and said, "We have not yet decided whether to swap off the kingdom of God for a new state government." In 1887. By 1890, they had made that decision, and they were going to swap off the kingdom of God for a new state government. Now, 1887, this is well after the 1886 revelation, Wilford Woodruff knew that this had been set up. He knew that the priesthood would carry on and the work would carry on. He also knew that the church wasn't going to do it.
So you guys come from different polygamous areas. And I live in St. George, and I had a coworker from Centennial Park. And one thing she mentioned is that women give priesthood blessings before a woman, to another woman before they give birth. And I was wondering, do all of you do that, or just in Centennial Park?
Well, have you read Women of Mormondom? That's a good example, like you're saying, of women as they were crossing the plains giving blessings of health to other members. I personally have given a blessing of health to my children when they were young, because my husband wasn't always in the home. Independent families, I think, are going to vary. I'm an independent. I'll let the other two speak for themselves, for the Allred group and for Centennial Park. But I think it's something that we believe they can give as a blessing of faith.
A lot of that's covered in my dad's book, 95 Thesis, and so it explains a lot of the different things that have changed through time, and that was an early doctrine, was that women did help.
Do you want to talk about the Allreds?
Yeah, that does happen in the Allred group, and it is come from the early teachings of the church, early practices.
And I was just going to say the same thing. It comes from the early practice in the church. The church no longer does it. We do it. I'm not a woman, so I've never done it nor received it, so I don't feel qualified to speak other than to say we do it. And I do believe that if you're expecting and you desire that you can petition our priesthood council for it, even if you're not a member.
And I'm sure that most of you know as well that that was allowed up until the 1940s in the mainstream church, just in case you didn't.
One time when I was very sick, three women gave me a blessing, and it had the greatest effect I've ever had.
Thank you. Hello. So I'm interested to know, for some Centennial Park or even broader than that, if there's any written or unwritten rules about the number of wives that a man may take, or the age that those wives could be taken, and also, like, if they're, again, written or unwritten rules about the timing between wives. Maybe there's a greater distance between the timing of the first wife and the second wife. And so I'm interested in kind of, you know, is it just a practice? Are there some unwritten rules about that? And then I'm also interested to know, for Centennial Park, like, what is, you know, the man with the largest number of wives, like, what is that number? I'm interested in that because, I look at some of the earlier prophets, and they had, you know, quite a number of wives, and I get the feeling that that's not the type of polygamy that you're probably practicing, you know.
Let me start with the first question.
Yes.
You live plural marriage when you have more than one wife, by definition. That's two. There are also quotes. I'd put together a little book called An Essential for Exaltation, talking about plural marriage. And in there was an experience by Brother Hunsaker, who had a vision or a dream. And a man appeared to him and said, "Unless you have three wives, as you see me have, you cannot come to where I am." Well, you can take from that who is the one that appeared. And so apparently he's talking about having three wives. When David and Solomon took all those hundreds of wives, they were not criticized by the Lord for the number of wives. They were criticized because they took foreign wives. So the Lord's not chastising them for taking that many in numbers, but the quality of wives. So now I know there are some groups, and I'll let them talk, because the independents have a little bit different look and more variety as well. So we don't say you have to have so many wives in order to achieve something, but I think some of the groups do.
We have one rule, and that is that the participants in the marriage ceremony must be over the age of 18. Other than that, it's directed by revelation. If two women want to marry the same man, and the Lord gives them the authority to do that, they do it.
And just to follow up on that, who does the revelation come through, or can it come through the women? Does it always come through the men?
It should come through the woman who's getting married should for darn sure have a revelation. The man that's receiving the plural wife and bringing her into his home should also have one. They both have a right to receive one. The authority by which that marriage is done, that priesthood authority, they have a right to have a confirmation of who they seal together. And if they don't get that confirmation and the couple still wants to get married, there is no way they can be forced. They can tell you, look, go to Hurricane and get married. Do what you want, but without that confirmation, we're not bound to do it. So that's my understanding. I'm not here in an official capacity. I'm here as me. So
that's
my understanding.
The case of revelation is very important. In my case, the one wife had a dream of the other wife and saw her very clearly before she ever met her.
Thank you so much for speaking and telling your stories. And I wanted to ask this question specifically to the women on the panel. In the feminist liberal Mormon community, there seems to be a lot of hatred towards polygamy because of the effect that it had on women. So, and you spoke a little bit about how your blessing has been greater from practicing plural marriage. So I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of like the benefits and blessings that you have found as women practicing plural marriage.
Well, there's a book that I co-authored, and it's called Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. There's 100 testimonies.
It's on Amazon.
It's for sale at Benchmark Books.
And it is there too.
It's testimonies of 100 women and experiences that they had that were of a positive nature. Not that there weren't challenges. We aren't trying to sugarcoat this principle by any means, but there are so many benefits that women temporally and spiritually have received from living this principle. And I could go on about many positive experiences in my life. I'm an independent woman anyway. I don't need to have a guy around 24/7, but I certainly appreciated him when he was there. So, and it gave me a chance to spend one-on-one time with my children. I had a job. Some women haven't got their college degree. They might work out something with one of the other wives to take care of the young children while she gets her college degree. I mean, I could go on and on about the advantages, but the stereotypes are what the media picks up on, and that is the welfare fraud and the underage and the forced and all that. This is why, since our book came out, for 15 years, we've tried to educate the public that that's not necessarily the case across the board. Unfortunately, it does happen, but look at the monogamous marriages you've got that abuse those things, too.
I'd probably have to say it's hard to pick a few to tell you, but it's simply a family pattern that is just inherently has more blessings. There's the sister-wives relationship between sister-wives that cannot be described in... It can't be really compared to anything. It's kind of like the best of having... a best friend and a sister and a mother and an aunt, kind of all in the same relationship. Women really need women as well as women need men. Probably the second bonus is having more parents for your children, a different love language, a different, you know, language style. It's just a different pattern. If we could just change our mindset about what happiness is, I think everybody would love it.
And even though I have not practiced plural marriage and have no current plans to do so, I do want to share my favorite quotation from a dear friend in Centennial Park. And she said something once when we were just hanging out. She said, you know, monogamy makes slaves of women. And I'm like, what do you mean? And I mean, I'm a mom. I'm a full-time tenured professor. I could use a sister wife at times, so, you know, I really do get, and I don't mean to make light of the religious foundation and doctrine for that, but the reality of day-to-day life, to have a close-knit group of women who I know are committed to the same family I am, I mean, in a very real way, that's liberating. And until you flip the script on that, you don't see it that way. So it's a really interesting way to view it, I think.
And then, probably the last question.
Yeah, last question. Well, oh, that's my sister. We have to let her talk.
it's actually dinner break after this. So
it is, too.
So nobody's coming in.
That is true. No one is in here next, so that's good.
Okay, so I'm pretty new to all this. And I was talking to John Hamer, and he mentioned that he'd worked with you, Anne. Mm-hmm. And he talked to me about how there were three different restorations. I don't know if this is a fundamentalist belief in itself or what, but there's the restoration of the priesthood first, the restoration of the church, and then the restoration of the kingdom of God. Is that a belief within the fundamentalist faith?
Yeah, historically, that's pretty accurate. The priesthood, okay, apparently, and this is debatable, was restored in about almost a year before the church was organized. Like the quote I said, the church needs the priesthood, but the priesthood doesn't need the church. So there was a period of time of almost a year that the priesthood existed separate from and without. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the church was organized in April 1830, so that's another restoration. And then the kingdom of God was restored in 1843. And that's one of the things that was mentioned that was changed after 1890. The polygamy came first, then the kingdom of God, and then the United Order. All happened in that decade, and that was kind of like dominoes. Those important principles. Brigham Young said the fullness of the gospel is United Order and plural marriage. When those two were gone, the rest of them just kind of fell down.
And so the church that was restored, you feel, has been apostatized? Has apostatized because they no longer...
Well, the 85th section of the Doctrine and Covenants says the house of God, meaning the kingdom of God, when you interpret that, will have to be set in order. Well, in order for something to be set in order, it has to be out of order first. So I'm not saying anybody's apostatized. I don't like that word particularly. I'm certainly not going to accuse the church of apostasy.
Yeah.
But apparently there's some things in which they're out of order, and so eventually those things will be set in order.
Mm-hmm. And then, sorry, last question. My perspective on how Joseph practiced polygamy is I feel like it was an abusive authority in some ways. I don't know. I don't know exactly how you guys feel about Joseph's practicing polygamy. I know he's the one that brought it forth. And I don't know if you have a different perspective of it, if you feel like the principle was correct, but the way you applied it was incorrect, which is how I feel.
Well, one of the favorite quotes of fundamentalists is, we're practicing plural marriage.
Just like doctors and practice
haven't medicine. Perfected.
You know, we're not really there yet. And there's a lot of isolated events that, you know, we all go through and we say, did this just really happen, you know? And so we're learning, we're progressing. I think that's how Joseph was doing it as well. One of the misnomers, I would say, is that a friend of mine said, well, you know, it must be the devil because, you know, here came this angel and said, if you don't live plural marriage, then, you know, you're going to die. We're going to take you out or something. And so in Mary Leitner's journal, which we publish, she made the statement that Joseph was given the knowledge about plural marriage and committed to it. He said, yes, I'll do it. And then the angel came and said, well, when are you going to do it? And he didn't do it for three times. So it was the third time that the angel came with the sword and said, look, you have to obey this. You made a covenant to this. And you're not obeying the covenant, and that's why there was the strictness of that. And so that's something that very few people understand, the reason why Joseph got into it, why he was doing what he was doing.
Just adding to that, there are 6 times where Joseph Smith received a revelation on plural marriage. I could go through them, but 1829, 1831 twice, 1834, 1835, and 1843. And probably it was a combination of those things that went into making up Section 132 of the DNC. So it wasn't just one revelation that came to him, okay, restore plural marriage. It was a series of events and revelations that ended up in that section.
And one of the most important to me was way before 132 was that Joseph received a commission by the Lord to marry the Native Americans that were there in the area, and he called them the Lamanites and Nephites of that area.
That was in 1831 he received that.
And so that was way before, and they were all married men, and so now the Lord said that they were very chaste women, very virtuous women, and, you know, he delights in the virtue of women.
I'd like to add that Joseph Smith had no example before him. This was given to him, and he's supposed to implement it. And I don't know that to justify everything he's done. I mean, the Lord has chastised him repeatedly in the Doctrine and Covenants and in the other revelations we have. He was on a path of trying to accomplish a great number of things in a short amount of time, and he made a mess of it, but he did it. And he got chastised, and he got rebuked, and he got forgiven. I find a problem when fundamentalists make similar actions, I'll call them mistakes, make similar mistakes, and then justify those mistakes because Joseph Smith did it. I have an issue with that. We know better. We have 100 years of examples in front of us. We've seen thousands, tens of thousands of people do it wrong. We've seen the complications that have come from doing it wrong, and we've seen the benefits of doing it right. So now we have examples, and we have, and like me, I'm practicing, I'm learning. But I have people that I can counsel with. And I'll give you an example. Somebody asked about how many wives the most, you know, married man in Centennial Park has. And I don't know, but I'm going to guess 10. And let's say he's 70 years old, and he's got 10 wives, and he's had most of them most of his life. And let's say he has 50 children. He's got so much experience. He's been married for 350 years. He's raised 51-year-olds. He's raised 52-year-olds. He's raised 50 teenagers of every... He's got experience. When I have an issue, if I go to him and say, hey, I need some advice. You know, this has gone on, that's gone on. He's seen it. You know, I don't have a real excuse to be bouncing off walls and fumbling over things when I have men that surround me that have that much experience. So I'm here to defend Joseph Smith. I believe he's a prophet of God. I'm not here to defend his every action because God chastised him. But it's not my place to chastise him. It's God's place, and he did. And as far as I know, he's forgiven. But I'm not here to say he made no mistakes.
This is just so surreal, by the way.
Yes, it is. I'm new to this as well, and I'm trying to understand your fundamental beliefs on revelation, because you had mentioned that you believe in personal revelation today for yourselves. So my question is, when does that cut off as far as for the fundamentalists in general? Say that you only believe what the revelations that Joseph Smith received? Because if you believe in modern personal revelation, what about the Mormon prophet who received revelation later that polygamy, it wasn't acceptable? I'm trying to understand it. Of where is that?
Well, revelation number one is defined by different levels, visions, dreams, voices, so that's all on the spectrum of revelation. A man is entitled to receive personal revelation for his family, but not for somebody else's family or not for an organization. I remember I would never have married my husband had I not had some kind of revelation to confirm to me that that was what I should do. There was another thought. But anyway, do you have anything to add to that?
I think from my perspective, because as I mentioned earlier, you know, revelation is very important to me. And I think it's an ongoing thing. I try and teach people about having dreams, how to see seership, how to have this. It's all a part of me. It's all a part of what I try and teach people, because I'm an independent. I'm not a part of a group. One of the problems I have with the group is that sometimes people start depending on the prophet for all their things that they need to do. And so I would say to teach them how to have revelation. Joseph one time took two men and laid down on the ground and had them lay on his arms so that they could have a vision. He was teaching them. He was having them experience that experience. And so that's what our side would be saying as far as revelation.
I think the question you're asking is, how can we claim to have personal revelation but say that the church can't have ongoing revelation to change some of the doctrines that have already been given? Why can't the prophet get a revelation that something has changed? And I think the answer to that is that truth is truth. And if truth has been revealed, we can't find new truth. We can have a revelation to change policies or practices, but we can't have a revelation to change doctrine. So if a prophet claims to be a prophet and goes against a former prophet, either one is right or the other, and that's what we have to have personal revelation to decide. Are they changing out of because they want to change like the world, or was the first prophet wrong? We just have to personal revelation.
One of the things that the fundamentalist people teach about is that in 1889, Wilford Woodruff got a revelation. It was a thus saith the Lord revelation. In fact, it was in one of the church manuals. They actually published it for the Sunday school. And in that, the Lord told them, is a thus saith the Lord, don't give in. Make no further pledges of my priesthood. You know, he was telling him, I have the courts in my hand. I have the ability. This is all going to be taken care of. And so he did have a revelation telling him not to do that. And then later he decided to do it. Now, even more prophetic than that was John Taylor. And John Taylor had a revelation. They asked him, they brought in a manifesto type thing to him. And he looked at it and went in and prayed. And they saw the light under the door and he came back out. And he said, heck no, I'm not doing this. You know, rank my tongue out, alarm, forget it, I'm not going to do this. But my predecessor will. And so he actually prophesied that Wilford Woodruff would do this. And so he set apart patriarchs and others to keep plural marriage alive. And so that's how it was all born. And not many people know that story or that history, but fundamentalists do. And so that kind of helps.
I was going to point out the 1889 revelation as well. Wilford Woodruff was specifically told by the Lord in a thus saith the Lord revelation, make no further promises or pledges, and I will protect you. And then in 18, I will fight your battles for you. I am in your midst. And in 1890, they signed the manifesto. But the only reason, the only way Wilford Woodruff would do that is if he knew that the organization of the priesthood had already been set apart and that these principles would stay alive.
Just as a challenge, does anyone know of a thus saith revelation since 1889 for the church? We've studied and studied and never found one that says, thus saith the Lord to my people, da 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 da. And so these changes then have come from the presidency of the church just based on what they felt was right, I guess.
One little quick thing
little
here.
Quick, cause we're
yeah, we're a little quick.
Jerry Spence, who was an attorney that never lost a case that had the tassels and whatever, worked with my father. He actually read all of my dad's books. He had an issue with blood atonement, but pretty much everything else he had a high regard for. He told my dad that in Wyoming, they were actually passing a law at the time that would have set a precedence so strong the plural marriage would have been allowed through the United States. But when Wilford Woodruff gave that, all the LDS people voted against that, and so that the Lord was actually setting it up so that it would happen. It would be allowed.
And so now it's decriminalized in the state of Utah.
It is. It is. You just slid that right in there.
Yeah.
That was fantastic news, actually. Yes.
Thanks for coming.
Everyone, thank you so much for coming. Big applause for all our panelists and their stories. Thank you. Thank you.